G'day and welcome to a Grad Chat, your opportunity to find out about graduate research here at Queen's. Yes, this is CJ the DJ. I'm your host today for this week's Grad Chat. Hey, I'm on the FM, is not able to be with you today, so it's good to be back. Of course, a show like this could not happen without the support of the School of Graduate Studies and Postdoctoral Affairs, as well as CFRC. So thank you very much to both of them. Now, if you may miss the show at any time, you can download the podcast the next day on either iTunes, Google Podcasts, Spotify, and CFRC Podcast. So no excuse not to hear what our awesome students and postdoctoral fellows are doing. Today, though, I'm very excited to introduce you to Amy Parks, who is doing a PhD in cultural studies under the supervision of Drs. Linda Jessop and Jeffrey Bryson, and Sam Jean, who is doing a PhD in biology under the supervision of Dr. Diane Orahel. Welcome to Grad Chat, both of you.
Good morning.
Good morning. Thank you for having us.
I can't wait to talk to you. And it's interesting, you know, you're probably wondering why I've invited two students onto the show for one session, because, you know, we haven't normally done that in the past. Well, Sam and Amy also have run the Queen's Swing Dance Club, which many of our grad students and community members take part in. So we'll be talking to them a little bit later about the Swing Dance Club, because you'll find it fascinating and how you can get involved. But first, I'd like to, as usual, talk to you a little bit about your research that both of you are doing. Now, you're both in very, very different programs. So we're going to start with just maybe, Amy, let's start with you. Mm-hmm. Your research topic is basketball myth and the Toronto Raptors. Pretty awesome. When I read that that title, I went, okay, basketball, that was my sport. You know, I love history, I love myths, all those sorts of things. So tell us a little bit about your project. What are you trying to accomplish here?
So I'm looking at the Toronto Raptors rebrand, which was around 2014, 2015. And I'm looking at it as kind of like an avenue into the ways that Canadian mythology, which I consider like mythology is the stories that we tell ourselves about ourselves. So national mythologies are the stories the nation tells themselves about ourselves, and the ways that we can look at how those myths change, and basketball, commercial basketball, as a media that participates in that transformation.
You've actually chosen a really important topic, I think, because with everything that's going on in the world these days, you know, national identity, those sorts of things are really, really important. I know as an Australian in sport, that is our culture. It's all about us participating in as many sports as possible around the world. And you can see that here in Canada as well. I mean, if you're talking about culture, ice hockey, or as you say here in Canada, hockey, is part and parcel of what Canadian history and mythology, I guess, is. So why basketball?
Well, it's funny because basketball, unlike hockey, has sort of a beginning date, and it was, quote, invented by a Canadian.
Yes, James Naismith.
Yes, but it was in the United States. So it has this ambivalent relationship already off the bat. So basketball, I want to argue that basketball mediates not only Canada's anxieties about being sort of north of empire, as one theorist put it, but also this relationship between the United States and Canada and the shifting ways that Canada sees itself in terms of U.S. power.
Okay. And U.S. power, again, with everything that's going on as well.
Yes.
Right now, very topical, which sort of kind of helps things. Now, you're using the club, and I call it a club, professional club, Toronto Raptors.
Okay, yeah, the franchise.
Yeah. So you're using that. Mm-hmm. Toronto Raptors have gone through changes itself from when it first started to where it is now, or to when it won the NBA and since then. What are you trying to show from the Toronto Raptors within your research framework?
Well, so far, my research shows that when they first started out, they had if you can recall, there are a lot of nostalgic throwbacks to this zany dunking dino.
It was a bit embarrassing, wasn't it?
Well, that's how it was framed, that even Canadians were sort of making fun of it, and I want to show how it was talked about in Canada as sort of this outsider figure that was within Canada, not accepted at first, or if it was accepted, it was part of this narrative of the United States sort of invading Canada through basketball.
Yeah, trying to have an influence through basketball.
Yes, and at the time, this would have been in the wake of NAFTA negotiations, so like a North American free trade, and things like the question of Quebec separatism and Indigenous sovereignty was sort of, there was a certain events that brought that into major public discourse at the time. And so Canada was thinking of itself in very anxious, insular, insecure ways.
Right.
And so the Raptors were this racialized, not that they're not racialized now, but in a very different way, racialized as this like sci-fi exotic outsider character. And so then you, 20 years later with the rebrand, you see a lot of things have changed. Canada's thinking of itself more as something that needs to perform more internationally. That I think it was Bono said, the world needs more Canada. And I'm not saying that I necessarily subscribe to this, but that sort of a little bit of confidence was infused into the way Canada thinks of itself. And in terms of related to the United States, where there was 9/11, you had the recession, which was a global thing, but especially hit the U.S. hard. And then you have the rise of things like Trumpism, where the U.S. is sort of receding from the world stage. Mm-hmm. And you have Canada finding itself way more confident in its own symbols. And that's reflected through the way that the Raptors rebranded with this tagline, "We the North."
We the North, which has been worded really well, hasn't it? Because one of the things I've found interesting, and looking at the basketball, looking at the Raptors, a lot of people, rightly or wrongly, see Canadians as always apologising, the sweet, friendly thing, which you all are. What I think the Raptors have shown is that you can be all those things. You can be good sportsmen and women, et cetera, but you can be tough as well.
Yes,
I mean, you can stand your own ground. And the fact that they won the NBA championship, that proves, you know, this club may be in Canada, but don't think we're easy baits.
Yes. And they did that. It was a really savvy turn because they took this history of being an underdog, not being, Toronto was not accepted as within the NBA as a place where a player would want to go. And they incorporated that into their own identity or their mythology and sort of aligned it with the way that Canada sees itself compared to the US. So it can see that there's like a nice alignment between mythologies at that moment in time, at least.
Lots of us to think about there.
Yeah.
And we could carry on, but I do need to get on and ask Sam about her work. She's sitting,
sorry, Sam.
Yeah, super
sitting there patiently.
No.
And so Sam, as we mentioned before, is in biology. And your research topic is the risk of microplastics to Canadian amphibians. So totally different landscape whatsoever, but also equally as important. Can you give us a bit of an overview of what you're trying to do in terms of microplastics and looking after the amphibians in our waterways?
Yeah, for sure. Yeah, a little bit of a different angle than Amy, but
still looking within Canada.
Yeah, I have a large focus on the idea of looking at these Canadian ecosystems. So the goal of my research is really to inform our understanding of the risk of microplastics. Microplastics being plastics that are less than 5 millimeters in size,
which is tiny.
And
does that include those ones that they keep saying these plastic bags are biodegradable? Because do they actually degrade totally?
So it's a little bit of a like play on words. So you can get degradable bags in the grocery store or in Canadian Tire if you pick up a box.
Yes.
So there's two types of microplastics. There's primary and secondary. So primary microplastics are ones that we make small. So like things like microbeads, which were in the news quite a bit a while ago. But secondary microplastics are more so what you're thinking about when you're thinking of those plastic bags. They're the microplastics that are the product of plastics that are breaking down. So degradable bags are designed to break down, but they break down into these smaller pieces.
But they're still there.
And they're still there. So not necessarily biodegradable, but degradable into smaller plastics.
Right.
And it's really a little bit different because we talk about plastic pollution a lot, like some of the bigger plastics as well. And you see them like on shorelines and stuff. Microplastics are particularly interesting because they're like, they can be the size of a grain of rice or smaller. Yeah. They look sometimes like sand.
Yeah, you don't see them.
And really tiny organisms like frogs, which is largely what I focus on, it's a lot easier for them to eat something the size of a grain of rice.
Because they don't know it's there.
They don't know
until they've digested it.
Yeah, exactly. So for my research, I run these large-scale mesocosm experiments, and mesocosms are model ecosystems. So they occur outdoors, and the goal is to kind of mimic the environment and make it really environmentally realistic. So we grow frogs from eggs in these mesocosms, which
Do you do this out of, say, cubes?
Yes, absolutely. Yeah. Sorry, okay. I do it out of cubes. Yeah. Yeah, we have a mesocosm facility there.
Great.
And we have all of our mesocosms, which kind of look like giant barrels. Are giant barrels.
They would be, yeah. With the frog spawn and then going into little tadpoles.
And then we raise them under different pollution scenarios to see what happens to their growth and development for the most part. So are there delays in development? Are there effects to growth? And how is that being affected by different concentrations of microplastics in their water?
Oh, so you're actually putting it in the water.
I might be, yeah.
She says that very quietly.
It's interesting, though. So, like, the goal is to understand not only what are the effects to their growth and development, mm-hmm. but also how are they acquiring them. So I've also run experiments where we've looked at microplastics in their food versus in the water to see where they're acquiring microplastics from the environment.
Right.
So risk is really this combination of factors. We want to know what's happening in the environment, what's out there. But we also want to know the effects. And then we really want to know the probability that those two things overlap. So are the concentrations we're seeing in the environment similar to the concentrations we're seeing effects occurring at? So it's a lot of stats. I'm a really, really big stats person.
Oh, you like stats. Well, somebody has to like stats, right?
it's like a puzzle. It's so fun.
Well, it would be like a puzzle. But it's interesting because, as you said, with these mesocosms, they're small. Out in the wild, like you said, the concentrations might not be the same because they've got, for instance, if it's a lake, there's a bigger part of the lake, it could be moved around more and dispersed.
Yeah, absolutely. So we do the best we can with the mesocosms. They're kind of a step up from laboratory experiments because these types of experiments are often also run in a lab. So we have the environmental pressures of like the weather changing and the seasons changing. Frogs take a while to develop. The species that I've looked at for developmental effects are wood frogs. And they are a bit faster. Our experiments are generally around 4 to 5 months. So we're out there for a while, but it's a lot faster than something like a bullfrog, which takes a few years. But yeah, we have these platforms that they can emerge onto. And then a few times now, we've also set up what I've been calling terrestrial mesocosms on the side, where we've filtered out some sediment and created a little like leaf litter habitat for them. And I'll take them off the platforms and move them to
and move them into that. Because I was wondering whether you were going to sort of rope off or net off an area where there's a tree and there's some bushes and...
Yeah, everything's kind of contained.
It, as you talk in other ways, environmental realism, because it has to look real, right?
Yeah, we're doing our best to mimic the environment as best as we can. There's obviously certain limitations, like the barrels are barrels. You're right, there's no like fluid dynamics as you would in a lake, but to the best of our abilities.
Okay, so ultimately, when you find the threshold, then what? I mean, what are you hoping people are going to use that for? Because we have a lot of conservationists that are keeping an eye on our waterways, etc. Is it more about what can we do to make our waterways cleaner, or is it because we also want the frogs to thrive, or combination, hopefully?
Kind of a combination. So because I'm focusing on only like for the developmental effects, I specifically focus on the wood frogs. The bullfrog studies are more so looking at how they acquire microplastics. But for the effect studies, we're creating those benchmarks.
Right.
In the hopes that kind of risk assessors, the people who are doing a lot more stats than me, sounds a lot of fun, maybe one day, are going to take those values in addition to other values from other studies that are looking at other species.
Right.
And they create this thing called a species sensitivity distribution. It's like a little S-curve. And they're trying to kind of figure out at what concentration we're protecting a good chunk of the species. They usually use a 95% threshold. Right. So at which point are 95% of the species protected? And then we provide that to policymakers and they can make decisions about what limitations we can put in the environment. The goal is ultimately to figure out...
to get rid of microplastics.
Well, figure out what is a good threshold for protecting our environment. It's a little different with microplastics compared to other contaminants. The risk assessment mm-hmm. process has been designed for like a lot of aqueous or liquid-like pollutants. And for microplastics, they're kind of different because they're both a physical contaminant. Like, they're there. You yes. can feel them and see them. I count them sometimes. It takes a very long time.
I bet it does.
But they're also a chemical contaminant. They have a lot of additives on them as well.
Mm, yeah.
So it's this combination. So we're still, like, I think, as a field, trying to kind of figure out how that risk assessment process is going to work with microplastics. But for now, like, the goal of my research is to try and inform it as best as I can.
Sounds like you're doing a great job on that.
Thank you.
And particularly if you like stats. So it's all yours.
Yeah.
Thank you. You know what? We're going to get onto the swing dance club now. What is the swing dance club? Why do you like it? Why should others like it? And how do they get to participate? Vice President Amy, go for it.
Okay. So Queen Swing Dance Club, or QSDC as we call it, it started in 1999. So we're at the end of our 25th year right now.
Brilliant.
And we aim to establish and maintain a swing dance community in Kingston and within Queen students. Now, what is swing dance? We mainly teach and enjoy, I guess, socially dancing Lindy Hop, which is a type of swing dance. It is danced to big band jazz from the 1930s and 40s. Not all swing dance is danced to jazz, but this Lindy Hop that we mainly dance is danced to jazz. We also focus on something called Balboa and Charleston, which are also jazz. Yes, yes. It's sort of a precursor to Lindy Hop in some ways.
Okay. Yeah, because that was in the 20s or 30s, wasn't
it? Yeah, yeah. There's actually different, like there's like 1920s Charleston, mm-hmm. 1930s Charleston. But Lindy Hop, the aesthetic of Lindy Hop is informed by a big band jazz that it danced in. It danced with, I guess. And it's this grounded, bouncy, stretchy, rhythmic dance. And it's partnered.
It's full physical workout.
Yes, it's quite athletic, actually. Yeah. And I don't know, Sam, if you want to talk about maybe the cultural history.
Yeah, the swing dance is a product of the Harlem Renaissance. So it is a Black cultural dance.
Right.
So it's important to us and important to the club. We reiterate it during each of our lessons that we kind of act like we're a guest in someone else's house. It's something we all enjoy to do as a community, but it's really important that we respect the roots. And I think even on our website, we have a few suggested readings from some of the workshops we've done. We've had instructors come in.
Yeah, yeah.
That's cool.
And we have some like supplementary cultural kind of days where we focus on that aspect and watch movies and talk about it.
Well, so it's not just come in and dance or show you how to do this dance. You are actually explaining to everyone what it's all about, which is good, actually, because sometimes we go into things and we only know part of the reason behind this particular product is there. And mm-hmm. so the fact that you're showing everyone, well, now this is where it's come from, which is important.
Yeah. And the people that continue to like steward it today are from that community as well, even though it's a global phenomenon.
So what made each of you want to get involved?
So it was a few reasons. For a while, like probably my first like 2.5 to 3 years of grad school, get really excited about your project, which I mean, I'm still excited about my project, but it's just like majority of your thoughts, you like sink in. And I was finding that a little tricky for me. I love my project. I love thinking about it, but you can't think about it all the time.
24/7 at times, thinking about frogs and microplastics.
Yeah, frogs are adorable, but they don't need to be my every thought.
No.
Yeah, so around probably my third year of grad school, I was really realizing that all of my extracurricular were to do with the biology department and like everything was related to biology, which is great. But I just wanted something else. So it was my partner and I decided to kind of put together this list of activities, and we did like 2 weeks of different activities every
day. Cool. That's a great way to try things out.
It was a little exhausting. I don't know if I can do an activity every day. There was like yoga. We went to a poetry lesson. We played badminton. We went swimming. There was a lot of things. But one of those activities was swing dance. So we went to a swing dance class. We weren't really sure if it was going to stick. It was just to try something new. And we loved it. It was the dance was super fun. It was a really great way to kind of focus on something else and do like kind of get out of my head and kind of be in my body. But more than that, it was also the community. Everyone was super welcoming. My partner and I loved that it was a very like ungendered space in terms of roles. Like we have a lead and a follow, but that's not necessarily gendered roles.
Right.
So we can do both if we want, or we can do either or. There's a big focus on consent in the community as well. Like we always ask to dance in the lesson, in the social, doesn't matter if you know the person. And we just really loved these values that were coming out and that respect to like the history of the dance and where it was coming. And it was like right at the beginning of the lesson. And we were like, oh, this is a space we really, really like.
That's cool.
And we've made some like really genuine friends through it who we really enjoy being around. I love it.
This it seems like swing dance has been around for a while.
So, yeah.
Because I hear it every now and then over the years. Like, oh, it's still going, which is really good. And it seems like a lot of grad students, majority of people are grad students. Is that correct?
I think there's a pretty good balance. We actually have a large chunk of, if not members, but regular drop-ins coming from outside of the Queens community.
That's great.
And we have people from ages 18 to 80. I don't know. I don't want to ask people their ages, but like there are people that have been dancing since the
70s. That's brilliant.
Yeah, and all kinds of dances. But we do certainly of if we compare to other Queens clubs, I'd say that we have a strong proportion that are grad students like Sam and I. There are a few other grad students on the exec. You know, I've met more people from different departments in grad programs here in swing dancing than out in the wild. Maybe not dissertation boot camp. That's another good place.
Absolutely.
So what about you? What brought you, Amy, to swing club, swing dance?
My story is not as exciting as Sam's. I am interested in partner dancing. I really like to get physical activity, but I like to find different ways to enjoy music. And dancing is this underrated thing these days that's like an opening to a new way to understand and appreciate music and also find new music that you like.
Right.
So a big part of it, maybe it surprised me how much I enjoy big band jazz and traditional jazz music that like I had no interest in before. And now I get to DJ sometimes and compile playlists, which is one of my
favorite things.
Yeah, but really, like for me, feeling music in your body is soul-fulfilling thing.
You know, it's interesting because a lot of the times when what music I play depends on what mood I'm in. And sometimes I play music because I want to be taken out of a particular mood that I'm in. But you're right, with music and that, and even though I'm not a good dancer, I love to have music, and before I know it, I'm sort of hips are moving or something, or the little foot's tapping and things like that. So to be able to combine those, and I think what's nice too is that, as you said, with your studies can be all encompassing. It's nice to be able to step back and do something totally different and just enjoy it. Meet new people, whether it's within camp, you know, on campus people or within the community. So in broadening your network, which great people to then talk about your research to and go, hey, this is what I'm doing. And get different perspectives and other people excited. So how do people sign up to be a part of the swing dance club? I mean, do you have certain times of the year where there's registration? How often do you run the club?
Well, the thing that we do, for maybe in introducing the club, I didn't mention that we are very beginner friendly, and we have an ongoing program on Monday nights that is specific to beginners, although anyone can dance because when you get more, you always have something to learn. So every Monday night during the academic year, so from September to April, we have beginner lessons that are not cumulative. So you can attend one. And you can buy a membership, which is very affordable. I think it's for students, it's $40 a year.
Oh, that's
for the entire year for every single Monday
night.
And that it gives you discounts on special events and everything. And so, yeah, so you just need some comfortable shoes. You don't need any special shoes. You do not need a partner. And you come to the lesson. and you sign some waivers and there you go. There's no registration ahead required. You aren't required to commit to anything. We'd be very happy if you want to be a member, but obviously you can try it out anytime.
I think that's wonderful. That's really cheap.
Yeah.
For something.
And we just, yeah.
And you said sometimes you do other events. So it's not just come to those. So sometimes do you put on a dance, do you? A specific dance?
Yeah. So a few times a year we'll do something a bit bigger. In January we had a Zero to Hero workshop, which is super fun. We've done that twice now.
Yeah,
I think so.
Yeah,
and it's supposed to take you from zero to hero, and at the end of it, we have usually a live band come in, and people come in for the evening and dance to a live band.
Brilliant!
So that one's super fun, and we also do things like end of year dance, where again we'll bring in a live band, usually about once per semester, sometimes twice.
Yeah. We also have DJed socials for a few hours after every lesson, so you get to we practice dancing in lessons so that we can dance socially.
That's fantastic.
That's the ethic of
yes, of yes. You know, I had this question here, and it was, how does swing dance affect your research? You might have answered it a little bit already, but how do you think, you know, swing dance affects your own personal research?
It's actually really greatly affected my grad school experience and my research, as a product of that. Because I've met so many other wonderful grad students, mm-hmm. I feel like there's a little bit of an exchange of ideas sometimes. We share research. Amy comes and meets me in the library all of the time.
There you go.
And dissertation boot camp.
And dissertation boot camp. We go to dissertation boot camp together. But a lot of people you can write with and bounce ideas off of, a lot of different kind of fields and perspectives too. So it broadens your perspectives, which really changes kind of how you view some of those societal questions about your research as well.
That's great.
As someone who researches culture, I see a lot of
overlap between
basketball and swing dancing. And it's not only because they have intersections in Black culture. It's also because of the rhythm of both of these cultural formations. In swing dancing, one of the hallmarks of jazz music, which is what Lindy Hop has danced to, is syncopation, which is this disruption in rhythms.
Yes.
And you see syncopation, you wouldn't call it syncopation in basketball, but when someone goes up for a layup or gets past their defender, for instance, they use deceptive strategies that act in a similar way to syncopation, in the sense that there's a disruption, especially in the bouncing of a basketball and the speed, the speeding up and slowing down in certain moments, that I see is very similar to Lindy Hop dancing when we dance to jazz music. So I see a lot of these aesthetic overlaps that I find really exciting.
So it's interesting, isn't it? I mean, one wouldn't even think research and swing dance could be working together, but there is those synergies there that you can use, which is brilliant. I'm loving it. Okay. So Sam and Amy, it's been great chatting with you both. Thanks for doing this for us. I hope a lot of people will register or come out. Where did they find out how to register or to do the drop-in? Is it on a website somewhere?
We have a Facebook page. We have an Instagram account at Queens SDC, so that's QUEENSSDC.
Right.
And we also have a website.
Yeah, our website also has a calendar, and we update not only our own events, but also events happening in the community.
Brilliant.
So there's other community members that'll throw on different dance events, and we make sure the community knows about that. So.
Fantastic. That's the way to do it, everyone. So go and check those out. I'm sure you're going to have a lot of fun. So that's it, everyone. Another week of Grad Chat sadly comes to an end. Don't forget you can download the show tomorrow from either iTunes, Google Podcasts, Spotify, and CFRC Podcast. Just type in Grad Chat. Until next week, where you'll have Katie Marie or KM on FM, she will be joining you again next week. But for now, this is me, CJ the DJ, signing off with a big hooray.